MacCast, Sunday, February 23rd, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, looking over the show notes for today, looks like we have a number of things to discuss, things going on in the Apple and Mac community. I'm going to talk about some new technology that may make your iPhone more useful for logging in. We're going to get into Apple and hearables. Yeah, we'll talk a little bit about that phrase and what's going on related to products in that category. We'll also talk a lot about future devices. We're expecting to get some announcements here pretty soon, and there's a number of rumors and information related to those products, as you might imagine. Talk about some new capabilities of Siri and also the expansion of a great feature in Apple Maps. And that'll kind of round out the news. And then we're going to get into some of your feedback. I got a lot of great feedback from the previous episode, my interview with Scott Johnson, all about using the Mac Mini as a pro computer. And I got some great feedback and comments from you. We're going to dive into some of those a little bit. We're going to talk about security and the Mac, a little story in the news. And I wanted to follow up on how you might better protect yourself in an age of increasing threats. And then we'll finish things out with a cool little tip that might bring back a retro feature for your Mac. So it should be a good episode. We will dive in just a moment. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a couple show sponsors. Starting off with Smile. I want to talk to you about Text Expander. I am reliant on Text Expander. I don't know what I would do without this software. I think anyone who uses a Mac or an iOS device can take advantage of Text Expander because it saves you time when you need to type things out, and it can boost your productivity. Basically, you make snippets for those things that you type repetitively. And if you stop and think about it, we type the same things over and over again. You might not notice it, but there's a great feature inside Text Expander that will watch what you type and tell you when you're repeating something. And when it notices you're doing that frequently, guess what? It will prompt you to turn that into a snippet. But I'm sure you take a second, you think about it, you'll figure out some ones that are really helpful for you. For me, it's things like answering emails for the MacCast community. I get a lot of the same questions. If I find I'm giving the same tip over and over again, I'll create a snippet for that, and it just saves me a ton of time. And what's cool about snippets in Text Expander is you can use them anywhere you type on your Mac. So your word processor, your email, messages apps, even online forms. And if you need something a little more sophisticated, you can totally customize your snippets with advanced features like fill-ins for dynamic information, pop-up fields, and more. It's got scripting capabilities, and it might sound complicated, but they are there to help you out as well. As a matter of fact, they have some free webinars going on right now, including a one with David Sparks. Yep, Mac Sparky of the Field Guides, also Mac Power Users. He is giving tips in February, so they're already up on the site now. And the support team is going to give a productivity co-webinar with Help Scout in March. So you should check those out. Even if you are an existing Text Expander user, you can probably learn some great things. But they're there to help you get the most out of the software. One of the things that I really love about Text Expander is the support. You can also manage and share your snippets if you're in a company with Text Expander. So they have the Text Expander for Teams, and Text Expander is available on multiple platforms, macOS, Windows, Chrome, iPhone, iPad. You can use your snippets across all of those platforms. So don't worry if you're on multiple devices, they have you covered there as well. And best of all, show listeners, you can get 20% off your first year of Text Expander. Just visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more about Text Expander, and a huge thank you to Smile for their support of the show. Another company I love and a company that supports the show is CashFly. Reality is, without CashFly, you would not be hearing this show right now, because they're the folks that make sure you get these episodes quickly and reliably, and they want to help you do the same thing for your website and business. Because when websites don't load, people lose interest. As a matter of fact, for every second a page takes to load, it costs a company about 16% in engagement, and fewer visits means fewer customers, and that's really not good for your business. Cashfly, though, they have your back with their new web optimization capabilities. All of your content will be optimized before it is delivered to your visitors without requiring any development effort from you. And with the recent addition of Cashfly's flexible edge application platform and implementation services, their capabilities reach far beyond that of any traditional CDN. Their web content optimization solution includes powerful APIs for solving your content distribution problems, on-the-fly next-gen image optimization, application load balancing, and smart asset delivery. Listen, if your website is directly tied to your revenue, and you know that it is, you can optimize your site's content now. Guarantee the best experience for all of your customers, no matter where they are or what kind of device they're using. The good people at Cashfly are even going to provide you a free optimization consultation just for listeners of this podcast. That's right, just for you. You can know exactly where your site stands today with a Lighthouse score report and learn how Cashfly's web optimization solution can help you add 60 points instantly to your score. Just visit mac.cashfly.com. That's mac.cashefly.com, mac.cashfly.com now to get that free Lighthouse score report and find out how Cashfly's web optimization solution can help you. And a big thank you to Cashfly for their support of the show. I think it's probably fair to say that most of us kind of hate having to have passwords and to manage passwords and to deal with passwords. It's not fun. Of course, we have great applications like 1Password or LastPass to help us manage those things and keep our information a little bit more secure. I think another thing a lot of us probably aren't huge fans of but understand the need for is two-factor authentication. But again, we know that's kind of a hassle. It's kind of a pain in the butt. And guess what? There's actually an organization out there that is trying to do away eventually with all passwords. And finally, according to the French site Mac Generation, Apple has joined the party. They've been kind of a latecomer, but I'm glad to see them there. The announcement is that Apple has finally joined the Fast Identity Online Alliance, or FIDO. FIDO is an open industry association started by PayPal, Lenovo, and a few others to try and help develop standards for passwordless authentication. Yeah, a world without passwords. The group also includes members like Amazon, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Samsung, and now Apple. It was all started in 2012. A bunch of the other members joined in like 2014. Apple's just getting around to it here in 2020. But it's ultimately a good thing because the current version of their technology is something called Universal Second Factor, which is an open standard to make two-factor authentication more secure and easier to use. Basically, the idea is that your devices end up working like a key. You can also get third-party devices like a YubiKey to be a physical key, or you can use, say, a chip in your device like the Secure Enclave chip in your iPhone to serve as that key. But you have this physical device, and it replaces the security code that you would typically have to enter for two-factor authentication. And the systems can also leverage technologies like biometrics, Face ID, Touch ID, those kinds of things for even more security. So to date, all major browsers, Chrome, Firefox, Edge, and Opera, have natively supported the UTF standard, starting with iOS 13.3, and Apple will be supporting it with Safari on iOS, adding the FIDO2 support for compliant security keys. So the long-term goal beyond all of this would be to remove the use of passwords altogether, rather. And the way that would work is the system would rely on you having logged in access to two physical devices, the device that you're using and trying to access a service from, and then another device that you could authenticate through, say through Face ID or Touch ID, and then verify that you're trying to log in. So what would happen in kind of an example scenario is imagine you're trying to log into a website on your Mac. you would enter just your username, and then an authentication request would be sent to your other devices, say your iPhone, where you would authenticate, say by Face ID, approve the login to the website on your iPhone, and then that would go back to the Mac through the technology and allow you to be logged in to the website. So no password whatsoever. And you might be wondering, well, how is that more secure than two-factor or a password? Well, it's secure because in order to gain access, an attacker would need to be logged in on both your Mac and your iPhone or device, or have access to one of your physical keys to be able to get access. And since FIDO is an open standard, those physical devices don't even have to be on the same platform. In early iterations, it's probably going to require, at least with Apple, that you have Apple devices, but in the future, it could be any device that supports the FIDO Alliance standards. So pretty cool stuff. And like I said, I'm glad that Apple is finally participating. They did specifically call out iOS 13.3 in Safari. I would assume this would also be coming to the Mac, but it wasn't mentioned in the Mac Generation article or any of the articles that I saw. But I'm excited to see this. We use the YubiKey technology at my office, along with some other technology that's similar from a company called Duo. There are a lot of participants in this. If you want to know more about it, you can check out the FIDO Alliance website. But again, glad to see Apple is finally participating in this, and I look forward to a day when we don't have to remember a bunch of different passwords for different websites, and we can use a system like this where it's all auto-generated at random per site, per login, all that sort of thing. Anything that can make us more secure online and better protect our privacy data and information is good, in my opinion, and I'm glad to see that Apple is participating in this now. According to a recent report, Apple continues to lead the hearables category. And yes, I did just cringe a little bit saying hearables. We're talking about truly wireless headphones. I'm just going to call them wireless headphones from this point forward because I kind of do really hate the term hearables. It's sort of like wearables for your ear. Whatever. This report, though, comes from Counterpoint Research, and they're predicting that in 2020, Apple will sell more than 100 million true wireless headsets. They claim that the market for true wireless headphones grew 53% in the fourth quarter of 2019, led by the popularity of Apple's AirPods. For 2020, they expect Apple to maintain their large lead in the premium category of truly wireless headsets. That would be headsets that are above $100 US, and they estimate that Apple will maintain a 70% share of that market. Recently, Apple has been struggling to keep up with AirPod demand, and the supply chain, of course, has been impacted by the coronavirus, and it may impact supplies in the future. So these numbers might fluctuate a little bit. We have heard reports of Apple shifting some of that component production and manufacturing to facilities outside of China to kind of deal with that. But another thing that's going to be happening in 2020 is Apple is, at least we're hearing rumors, planning on expanding or possibly expanding the lineup. There is one odd rumor that came out this week from Digitimes, who has a hit and miss record when it comes to Apple rumors. They say Apple is working on something called the AirPod Pro Lite. That was how it was written in the article. I assume they mean AirPods Pro Lite. Of course, they don't mention any details of exactly what it is. It's just kind of a footnote in a report that they put out. A lot of us are curious about where a device like this might fit in to the lineup, because typically you would think if it's a light product, they're thinking a lower price point, but then it's got that Pro moniker on it, so that would imply a higher price point. But if you look at the current lineup, AirPods start at $159 for the charging case, and then you have AirPods at $199 with the wireless charging case, and then AirPods Pro at top end of the lineup at $249 US. So there's not a lot of space in between those areas. One point of speculation that I read about that I sort of agree with is it could be that Apple plans to make the entire lineup include wireless charging cases, dropping the price of the AirPods to $149 with a wireless charging case, opening up that kind of middle range for these rumored AirPods Pro Lite, which could be similar to the design of the AirPods Pro, but maybe without the higher-end feature like the noise cancellation. And that could come in at $199, and then they'd continue to market and sell the AirPods Pro with the noise cancellation at $249. And that would kind of have a nice range of price points and feature sets when it comes to the AirPods. So that lineup, I could see. Whether or not that's what's actually going to happen, we're going to have to wait and find out. Another thing we've been hearing on the wireless headset wearables front is that Apple is working on a higher end set of over-the-ear headphones. As a matter of fact, this week, Target's in-house inventory system started showing a placeholder listing for a number of possible future Apple products, including maybe these new headphones. They had an entry for what was called AirPods X generation, and the X meaning like a placeholder for, you know, generation one or two or three, for $399. So that would be $50 above where the AirPods Pro currently sit. And we had been hearing rumors for a long time that Apple wants to do an Apple-branded version of over-the-ear headphones. So could these be that? Maybe, possibly. The Target system also had entries for an Apple TV Gen X for $180, an iPod Touch Gen X for $400, and Apple Watch Series X Band for $50. So looks like there's probably some updates coming. We were kind of expecting some of these. Next generation Apple TV, we haven't heard too much about, other than I think we did discuss maybe a new version of the Apple TV 4K with some updated processors. It is kind of time for a new iPod Touch. And of course, seasonally, Apple does swap out those bands. So all of those things make sense. Getting back to Apple audio products, while they are dominating the wireless headphone or headset space, one area where they're struggling a little bit is still the smart speaker market. A Strategy Analytics report came out this past week. The good news is that HomePod shipments did grow in the fourth quarter of 2019, up from 1.6 million in Q4 of 2018 to 2.6 million units in 2019. So about a million units in growth. That's pretty darn good. But still, that gives Apple just about a 4.7% share of the overall smart speaker market. Amazon and Google continue to dominate with 28% and 25% of the market, respectively. It's likely that HomePod sales have been helped over the past year by some nice discounts that have been offered by retailers. I know I've seen prices as low as about $199, maybe even $179 if you can find the right deal. And that's a pretty good deal on a HomePod. I think things could be further helped out if rumors of the new lower-priced HomePod turn out to be true. If Apple can get something in the about $100 to $150 range, I think that would really help boost adoption of the HomePod. I still absolutely love my HomePod. I use it all the time. I think it's a great device. I've even been tempted by some of those offers to maybe get a second one for the living room of the house. And everybody I know who has a HomePod loves them, but it is kind of hard to compete in the smart speaker space when you've got Google and Amazon with devices down in that $50 range. So I would like to see Apple expand out the lineup for HomePod. I think that will help out. But what do you think? Shoot me some feedback. Send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. This week, we continue to hear rumors about potential issues in the supply chain from the coronavirus outbreak. It's still having a significant and devastating impact in China, which is unfortunate. And we do continue to hear reports that Apple's 2020 product plans could feel the impact. Immediately, it could happen with the rumored iPhone 9 or the update to the iPhone SE 2. There are reports that Apple is trying to shift some of the production for those products from China to Taiwan and India. It's expected that full production on the updated device could start in the next few weeks, and it is still believed that Apple could announce and release the device in the first half of this year. Remember, this is a device that's supposedly going to look very similar to the iPhone 8 with some updated internals, new processors, new camera system, and a lot of people are very excited about that because it would come in at an entry-level price point. Rumors are pointing to about US$399. Some predictions are pegging an event around the end of March, possibly on Tuesday, March 31st, to announce some of these new products. Right now, that's probably just an educated guess based on previous years. Apple has typically done an event in March, and over the past few years, it has been pushed closer and closer to the end of March. Depending upon how production goes, I have a feeling that date may slip even further. We could see it fall into April if Apple continues to have production delays. As far as the next generation iPhone goes, DigiTimes say they think the iPhone 12 might not be able to begin production until June, which could result potentially in launch delays. Apple is currently not able to send engineers to China to assist with things like the engineering validation tests, and these are some of the things that need to happen early in the production phase so that they can move into full production later. So definitely there's an impact going on there. Again, they're trying to shift some of the production outside of China, but remember, those Foxconn facilities in China, they have much more output capability than some of Apple's other suppliers and vendors. So it's reasonable to assume that iPhone 12 supplies this year are going to be impacted one way or another. What I would expect to happen is that Apple will stay on track to give their typical announcement and event in September, but then sales might be slower or impacted significantly due to the constrained supply of devices. So every year we seem to have issues getting iPhones once they're released in terms of the supply, Apple not able to keep up with demand. And this year, because of recent events, it is going to be even more constrained than usual. This year should be the first year of the 5G iPhone, and everyone seems to be taking guesses at exactly what iPhone 12's 5G capabilities might look like. We've had reports this week that Apple and Qualcomm are potentially working together on a new custom antenna design, while most reports are saying that things are fluid, so take all of this with the grain of salt. Ming-Chi Kuo is no longer sure if Apple will have a 2x2 MIMO uplink. Originally, he thought that the device would support up to 6 power amplifiers. Now, he believes there may just be 1 or 2. And what that means for you and I is that it could reduce the theoretical maximum upload speeds, but that may not matter too much, especially in the early days of 5G rollouts from the carriers. So it's a typical thing where we hear everybody wants the latest and greatest 5G technologies. The carriers aren't really ready to support it. The modems may or may not support it. The phone designs may or may not be able to deal with it. And just like we saw with 4G, I think you're going to see slow rollouts from Apple that support the existing technologies for the years that the iPhones come out. And as new capabilities and new technologies become available, they, of course, will update the devices. And speaking of that, Qualcomm does have a new 5G chip that's pretty exciting, one called the X60. Currently, Apple was reported to be not interested in the current generation X55 design, which is the one that is deployed in a number of existing 5G devices already on the market. It's kind of the 2019 chip. The 2020 chip that's being released is this new X60. And the reason Apple wasn't interested in the X55 was this belief that Apple was interested in more of a custom design, sort of custom antenna features, and that's what they've been going back and forth with Qualcomm on, according to reports. Of course, there's a slightly strained relationship between Apple and Qualcomm, especially over licensing costs for antenna technologies, and we know that Apple has built out a pretty impressive in-house team all working to design their own cellular modems. So what actually happens? Who knows if they do end up going off the shelf with the X60? It has some really nice features. It's more future-proof than the X55. It supports both mmWave and sub-6 frequency and is capable of up to 7.5 gigabits per second download speeds and 3 gigabit per second upload speeds. So it's an impressive chip, and even more importantly for Apple and the iPhone design, the X60 is built using a 5-nanometer process. So that means it is smaller and more compact, something that Apple is always keen on for chips in their iPhone designs. Still, the chip is just becoming available in the first quarter of 2020, so we may not expect to see it in this year's iPhone. Apple might have to go with something else, and we might see the X60 in future iPhones sometime in 2021. Another Apple device that's expected to see updates soon is the iPad Pro. There are reports circulating that we could see an updated iPad Pro lineup this March at that special event. It's expected that the iPad Pro will come with a new rear camera system with that triple lens design and also add in 3D sensing technology for better augmented reality experiences. It's also believed that the new iPad Pro could get a processor update, probably an A13X Bionic. And according to DigiTimes, production has already started. And as you may have already guessed, though, that production is also impacted by the coronavirus outbreak in China. So it's expected to be in short supply at launch as well. Another rumored Apple product that could be hitting the market soon is Apple's tile-like tracking system known as AirTags. Ming-Chi Kuo says Universal Scientific Industrial will begin supplying the system in package for the device that could arrive in the second or third quarter of this year. The trackers will reportedly be small tags that you can attach to items like your keys or your wallet and will use the iPhone 11 series' ultra-wideband technology to help you pinpoint and locate your items if you've misplaced them. Tracking would be added to the Apple Find My app and would display things like distances and possibly even offer augmented reality features to show you the potential location of your items. There have been rumors of the tracking tags since last year when code and user interface references were discovered in developer builds of iOS 13, but we did not see the product in 2019, so it is expected that we might see it this year. It's possible AirTags could debut along with the iPhone 9 and those updated iPad Pros we just talked about at that rumored Apple event in March. If you've been interested in following along with the current presidential primaries and are also interested in future election information, looks like Siri might be able to help out. You can now ask Siri to give you information related to the 2020 U.S. elections. As a matter of fact, you can ask things like, when are the California primaries or who won the Nevada caucus, and she will return information. Most of the results seem to be coming from the Associated Press and the Apple News app, but the new functionality should work on anything that supports Siri, iOS devices, the Mac, Apple TV, and even your HomePod. Here's some great news. If you use an app on your iOS device to browse the internet or get email that isn't Apple's app included with your device, Bloomberg is reporting that Apple is considering allowing users to select their own default apps for things like mail and web surfing in a future version of iOS. Thank goodness, right? You might be able to set your preferred music app as well, and the functionality could be extended onto the HomePod too, something that I would be very excited about. This is a big change to the way it is now, but Bloomberg reports that Apple is considering it because of increased scrutiny over the App Store and the rules that some perceive are limiting competition. For music on iOS, you can, of course, already request that Siri play in a different audio player, but you have to say the name of that service when you're making the request. This would change that, simply changing the default music app, the default mail app, or the default browsing or browser on your device so that when you actually click a link or request music, it will just come up in your preferred system. Regardless of any complaints against Apple's rules, I think, especially for HomePod, allowing alternatives to be set by a user is a good thing for device sales and even more importantly for customer satisfaction. As I said earlier, I think it's just about time. Many users, I think, prefer to use apps like Google Apps, for example, Maps, Gmail, and Chrome. You should have the option to let these be the default apps when you click on links to access websites, send emails, or even look up directions. Choice is always a good thing, in my opinion. It always bothered me that Apple hung on for so long or has hung on for so long with limiting us to having to use Safari and the built-in mail app or the built-in calendar. I, as you know, am a big fan of third-party apps. I use Spark as my email client, and I use Fantastical for calendar. So the ability to change those defaults is a welcome addition, in my opinion. But how do you feel about this? Do you think it's time? Do you think this might ultimately hurt Apple in their devices? I don't think so, but maybe you have a different opinion. Shoot me an email, send me an audio comment, maccast@gmail.com. And then finally in the news for this week, some more good news, especially if you live in Boston, Philadelphia, or Washington, D.C., because you can now access Apple's Look Around feature on their maps. This is Apple's version of Street View, and personally, I think it's amazing. Apple already offers Look Around in Houston, Los Angeles, Las Vegas, New York City, San Francisco, and Oahu. So three more cities being added is a great thing. I am selfish, though. I can't wait for them to roll that out in San Diego, where I live. They can't get to it fast enough, in my opinion, but they are working on it. The way you can tell Look Around is available is when you're in a supported city looking for directions or looking up things in maps, there will be a little binocular icon visible in the maps interface. Tapping on that will bring up the Look Around view, and you can street level navigate through your city, even finding points of interest that you can tap on to get more details and information. If you haven't checked it out, it's worth looking at, even if it isn't available in your city. Go into one of the supported cities that we just mentioned and take a look. I'd love to know what you think. Just as an aside, another cool feature that I started using frequently is Collections. That is available in the Maps app right now. And what it allows you to do is add places to a list of items that you can then go back and access easily to find. So you can create little collections of your favorite places and do them by different categories. You can even create different collections. So maybe you have your favorite local restaurants. I created one for my local breweries that are around me. And yes, as of current count, I think I have 29 on my list. And another cool feature of collections is that you can actually tap to share them easily with other people. You can generate a link, or you can send them through AirDrop, or email them through email, and even send them via messages to a friend, and then they can then add that to their own collection. So the way you add collections is in Maps. You slide up on the little info panel to see the collections section, and you can tap on new collection to create a new collection, name it, and then simply tap create. And then when you're viewing a location or a point of interest inside its info panel, you can tap on the Add To button to add that location to your collection. It's a pretty cool feature. I like using it, and if you find it useful, let us know. And of course, if you have any additional tips related to Maps or anything else Apple or Mac related, you can send those tips and comments to maccast@gmail.com. But with that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a moment and thank another show sponsor. You know, I've probably never mentioned this before, but I am not a really big fan of crowds, and I get somewhat nervous when I travel. So I really appreciate anything that can help me reduce my stress when I'm traveling and when I'm at the airport. So that's why I'm excited about our newest sponsor, Clear. Never run to your gate again, because Clear helps you get through security with the tap of a finger so you can get to your gate faster and reduce your pre-flight stress. You can get through security in a tap. Clear replaces the need for physical ID cards, using your eyes and fingertips to get you through security because you're the best ID out there. Best of all, it's super easy to sign up. You can create your account online before going to the airport, and then once you get there, a Clear ambassador helps you finish up the process, and you can immediately begin to use Clear. Clear helps you get through security faster in 65-plus airports and stadiums across the country, and they have more being added every day. And if you're traveling with a family, up to 3 family members can be added at a discounted rate, and kids under 18 are free when traveling with a Clear member. Clear is absolutely the best way to get through airport security, and it works great with PreCheck as well. Right now, listeners to my show can get their first 2 months of Clear for free. Go to clearme.com/MacCast and use the code MacCast. That's clearme.com/MacCast, code MacCast for your free 2 months of Clear. And a big thank you to Clear for their support of the show. Last week, I did an interview with my friend Scott Johnson about his transition from a 2013 Mac Pro to a Mac Mini as a pro computer. And if you haven't heard that episode, I encourage you to go take a listen. I think it was a really good one. And after that episode, I got a lot of great feedback from you, many of you who seem to agree that the Mac Mini is a great option for professional use. Many of you responded to say that it got you thinking about the Mac Mini again, and that was something that I would hope it would do. Mac Mini has always been one of my favorite Mac models. I've had a couple of them over the years, and this current iteration, I think, is one of the most exciting versions ever, even though the price has come up a little bit. But I think it still has a lot of good value, and there's a lot of range in the lineup depending upon how you configure it. And I think that's ultimately what Scott responded to. And I've heard from many people that are saying similar things, especially if you already have a great keyboard and mouse setup and you have great monitors. Maybe you don't want to pay for something like an iMac where you're paying for that built-in display. Still, I think where we ultimately landed in that episode is sort of the right place when it comes to how do I decide which Mac is right for me, and that ultimately is what I said in that episode, that you need to start with your needs, you need to start with your workflow, you need to start with things like, hey, I already have some great components that I want to reuse, or no, I want to start from scratch with new technology. And that was really highlighted by one response that I received from listener Ian. He wrote in to say that he was looking at the options between a 21.5-inch 4K iMac that was spec'd in the same way as a Mac Mini. And when you put those two side by side, it seemed like the iMac was actually a better value. And just to kind of dive into this a little bit, here's the configuration that we're talking about. So if you take a 21.5-inch 4K iMac, you configure it with a 3.2 gigahertz 6-core 8th generation Intel Core i7 processor, 32 gigabytes of RAM, a 512 gigabyte SSD. That iMac comes with a Radeon 560X GPU with 4 gigabytes of RAM, includes a Magic Mouse and a Magic Keyboard, all for the price of US$2,600. If you configure a Mac Mini with identical specifications, 3.2 gigahertz, 6-core, 8th gen, Intel Core i7 processor, 32 gigabytes of RAM, 512 gigabytes of SSD, add on the Sonnet eGPU, which also has the Radeon 560X GPU with 4 gigabytes of RAM, add in a Magic Keyboard and a Magic Mouse, assuming you're buying them new, that comes priced out at US$2,700. So actually about $100 more, and you still don't have a 4K display like you do the iMac. So yeah, in that configuration, that scenario, the iMac may be a better deal than the Mac Mini. But again, going back to that original point, is that Mac iMac actually the configuration that you need? Because guess what? That iMac maxes out at 32 gigabytes of RAM. So if you wanted more, say like 64, you'd be looking at a Mac Mini. If you wanted more storage, the iMac maxes out at 1 terabyte SSD. The Mac Mini, you can get up to 2 terabytes of SSD. So you may need to turn to the Mac Mini. Maybe you already have a great 5K display and you're not interested in going down to a smaller 4K display. There's a lot of things that can come in and factor in here. There's also potential upgradings. There's some port differences. As a matter of fact, the iMac has just 2 Thunderbolt 3 ports, whereas the Mac Mini has 3, and the Mac Mini also offers an HDMI port that includes digital audio support as well, something that you don't find on the iMac. So, yeah, one might be or seem like a better value where you're getting more for your dollar, but it may not meet all of your needs and you might need to look at a different configuration. I think, again, this really illustrates the point that the solution, the answer for what Mac you need to buy is going to be very, very varied. Sounds a little bit funny. Very varied depending upon what your specific needs are. And you need to really figure out what those are before you go in and build out a system. Obviously, you also have to consider what your budget might be and adapt those configurations accordingly. I think the really great thing that this proves is that there is a lot of variation, variety across the Mac line, and you should be able to find the exact Mac that's right for you in the price point if you know where to look. And I think another thing that came out in that episode is that Apple maybe needs to do a little bit better job of helping us know where to look. It's not always clear the system that you might be looking for. As Scott pointed out, he was coming from that pro space, that kind of, you know, the word we don't like, prosumer space. And he really needed something that fit inside a certain budget range and had certain features. And the Mac Mini wasn't really the obvious choice up front. But once you start digging, once you start playing with the configurations, you can find that solution. And for Ian, that's looking like it's probably more a 21.5-inch 4K iMac than it is a Mac Mini. But wow, isn't it really cool that we have all of those choices? So I'm very excited about the Mac lineup. You know, for the longest time, I've been a MacBook Pro owner, but more and more, I've come to realize that for my mobile needs, my iPad meets 90-95% of my needs, and I probably would prefer to have a little bit more power, something sitting on my desk. Honestly, my MacBook Pro functions almost like a desktop. I hardly ever disconnect it. I hardly ever take it with me. So my future Mac is probably going to be some form of a desktop. Will it be an iMac or a Mac Mini? I don't really know. It's probably going to depend on how Apple changes up the lineup. But I'm hoping that they take the Mac Mini even further, and I'm very excited to see a potentially new designed iMac, which is something that we've talked about in previous episodes as well. I'd really like to see them with the iMac move to all SSD. I think that's something that will happen, and it's probably time for a refresh of the overall design. And based on what we saw with the Apple Pro Display XDR, I'm hoping some of those little elements come into play in that new design. But we'll just have to wait and see. Of course, many of you are still sending in your thoughts and opinions on what future features you'd like to see in an iMac. I'd like to kind of expand that into the Mac Mini or maybe just the Apple computer lineup in general. How about what kinds of features would you like to see in future Macs coming from Apple? I'd love to hear your thoughts and opinions. Please send your emails and your audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. Something we don't really talk about too much in the Apple community is malware and security on the Mac when it comes to adware, spyware, viruses, and all that stuff. And that's often because the Mac is usually pretty secure and good at managing that stuff. We do bring it up from time to time, and you know, I tell you all to stay diligent. Well, an article came out this week, or actually a report from the folks over at Malwarebytes. It was their 2020 State of Malware report, And it was looking a little bad for Apple and the Mac, if we're being honest. They say that Mac threats increased 400% from 2018. Now, that sounds pretty grim, but they do point out in that report that part of that increase is also potentially from the fact that more folks started using Malwarebytes to scan their systems, and some of those infections and things that were found might have been there for years. So they did a lot of marketing. There's a lot more awareness of Malwarebytes as a tool, and so they were looking purely at their software and what it was detecting and on what platforms and systems it was detecting, and that was part of that Mac increase. But still, they also broke it down in looking at how many things were detected within those scans per platform, and on Macs versus Windows, there were 11 items per endpoint or per machine that were found in 2019 on Macs versus 5.8 on Windows. So there definitely is something going on with the Mac. It is becoming a bigger target, likely because of its popularity. But there is some interesting perspective in this report as well. The kinds of things that Macs are being targeted with are things like adware and something called PUPs, or potentially unwanted programs. So we're not so much seeing exploits of the security systems. What we're seeing is software that actually gets installed by the end user, and that seems to be the main target. So adware like NewTab, Genio, Operator, and MindSpark, and potentially unwanted programs like PCVark, MacKeeper, MacBooster, etc. As a matter of fact, some of the top threats we'll just go into a little bit, because I think it's good for us to all be aware of these. I had not heard of NewTab, but it was sort of the top adware that they were finding on Macs. And it's an adware family that attempts to redirect your searches in the web browser for the purpose of earning illicit affiliate revenue for the adware writers. And it is mostly delivered, in the form of apps that are embedded as Safari extensions. So this ends up installing an extension inside Safari, and then it starts redirecting your searches in the browser to get you to give affiliate revenue to the bad actors. Genio, you may or may not have heard of. It's been around for a long time in the Apple community as a piece of adware. It's actually the oldest piece of adware on the Mac. They keep tweaking it, though, and it's getting tougher and tougher to remove it. And as a matter of fact, because it so ingrains itself into the system, it kind of crosses the line from being pure adware into really a malware, because they are using and taking advantage of system vulnerabilities to get deep into and to infect your system. Users who have Genio installed, again, will find their search engines replaced and their browsers hijacked, getting sponsored results and pop-ups and all kinds of nasty, nasty stuff. Another thing that was in the report was something called fake file opener. This one is crazy because it actually hijacks the built-in macOS functionality that directs you to the App Store when you're trying to open up an application that is, or a file that has a file type that the Mac doesn't recognize. So there's a built-in feature in your Mac. So say you're trying to open up a file with a certain kind of extension, your Mac doesn't recognize what application would open that. It will give you a pop-up and prompt you to go to the Mac App Store to find an app that supports that file format. When fake file opener gets installed onto your system, it hijacks that request and redirects you to a page indicating that your Mac might be ironically infected with malware and offers a malicious download to help you remedy the situation. And you probably have seen this or might have had friends or family who have called you up and said, "Hey, I keep clicking on things and I keep getting these pop-ups saying that I have malware and that I need to download this scanner and install it." Of course, you never want to do that, but for folks who do, that software then further infects your system. So this is pretty nasty stuff. So What do we as Mac and Apple owners do? What should we be doing? I think, really, again, it's worth noting that almost all of the Mac threats in this report, except for one, involve tricking the user into installing something onto their system, installing an application that they shouldn't be installing. So it's relatively easy to prevent this kind of infection if you're aware of the potential threats, which is why we're talking about it. But what we need to do, because we tend to be, I don't want to make assumptions for you, but we tend to be the nerds, the tech support folks in our families. So we need to take this information, we need to educate our friends and family, tell them what's going on, make them aware of these kinds of threats, and make sure that they're not installing something potentially bad onto their system. And what that essentially translates into is just being suspicious, being on alert. Any pop-up that is asking for permission to install software on your Mac, because of the security features that are built in, it is going to pop up. You cannot install software on your Mac that's not signed, that's not approved, if it's not something that's officially coming through the Mac App Store and sort of blessed by Apple. It's not just going to run and install. It will ask for permission, and you need to often provide that for it to work. So when you see those pop-ups, read the message thoroughly. And if there is any doubt on what this is, if you're unsure in any way, if it feels suspicious in any way, you say no, and then you go and do some more research. Take note of what it's trying to say. What is the name of the application that's trying to be installed? Say no, go out and Google it, unless you implicitly know that you are installing it. And, you know, if you are installing things that are free utility apps that promise to clean your Mac, do things like purge memory, boost your download speed, boost the speeds of your Mac, be wary of those. A lot of these, especially when they're free, there has to be a cost associated with that, right? Somebody is making some money somewhere. Now, that's not to say there aren't legitimate tools for these kinds of things that are free, because there are. There are actually some great ones out there on the Mac. But again, be suspicious. Do your research on the app before you install it. Make sure that it's not a piece of malware or spyware or something like that. And really know what you're installing. There's some great legitimate tools that do these sorts of things, cleaning up your Mac, purging, cleaning up memory, doing maintenance, and they can help. Applications like Clean My Mac 10, Onyx, Cocktail, Malwarebytes for scanning for these things. Also be very careful and leery of, you know, apps that claim to clean viruses and things like that. Make sure it's a legitimate one and you know what you're installing. I can vouch for Malwarebytes. I use it on my system. And if you do end up seeing an increase or things on your Mac that are suspicious, like weird ad pop-ups that you're not expecting, or things that seem to be redirecting your search results, like if you're not getting the search results you're expecting, if they look odd and suspicious, run a tool like Malwarebytes, and it can probably help you identify if you've been infected and give you steps to help clean up your Mac. I think it's also worth noting that Apple has done such a great job at securing their platform that even if the number of threats that Apple users are facing have gone up, we're not seeing anything new in terms of attack vectors. This is the same old tricks that they've been using for years to try and get us to put this stuff onto our Macs. They're just ending up being a little bit more successful, and it's happening more frequently because Macs are becoming more popular. So we're bigger targets, and they're looking to exploit the growth of that Mac user base. So once again, be diligent, don't panic, share the information with your friends and family, and we can all keep ourselves in this community better safe, or more safe and better protected. And then finally for today, back in 2016, there was a crime committed against the Mac and the Mac community by Apple, and that was the removal of the Apple startup chime. Yep, You may remember back in 2016 that 2016 and later Mac models no longer gave that wonderful bong sound when you did the startup, when you powered up the Mac. And many of us in the community were devastated at the loss. And of course, this wasn't truly a crime, but many of us felt that, you know, we had lost a really great bit of Apple nostalgia, and it was disappointing, right? None of us really liked that. Of course, Apple wasn't just doing it for no reason, although for many of us, it wasn't really clear why the startup chime was removed. And so in case you don't know why Apple took it out, the main reason it was removed was that Apple changed how its notebook models would power on. 2016 and later models have a feature where if you open the lid of your Mac, even if it's not connected to power and it's powered off, it will power itself on. Also, if you connect it to a power adapter while the lid is open, it will power itself on. If you connect it to a power adapter while its lid is closed but it's connected to an external display, it will power itself on. And so Apple figured many users might not want the chime to sound in those scenarios, especially the one where you have a Mac that's been shut down, you open the lid, maybe you're in a meeting, maybe you're someplace where you want it to be silent. So it's kind of performing like you're just opening it up. And it also has to do with, I think, the switch to SSDs, because they power on more quickly, so people are more likely to power them off, and then opening the lid would power them on, and that chime constantly going might not be desirable. Of course, there's a lot of people like myself and others who are nostalgic and really like the chime and would love the option to turn it back on. And as a matter of fact, not long after the removal of the chime in 2016, it was discovered that Apple didn't completely take the chime and the sound out of the system. What they did was just disable it. And quickly, somebody found a command that would allow you to turn the chime back on. But then that was quickly removed in a future update of Mac OS. Well, good news this week, if you're a fan of that chime and you have a 2016 or later Mac model that doesn't make that joyous tone when you start it up, a command has been rediscovered that you can run to turn it back on. And this seems to be available in the latest version of Mac OS Catalina and seems to work with most Mac models, although it's not clear if it will work with all of them. It is a terminal command. So if you want to turn it back on, you're going to open up the terminal, which you can find in Applications Utilities Terminal, and you will type the command. I'll have this in the show notes at maccast.com for your convenience as well, but you're going to type sudo, S-U-D-O, space nvram, space startup mute, and that's all one word with a capital S, a capital M, equals percent 00, and then hit return. And you'll need to authenticate with your Mac admin password, but that will change the setting. And then the next time you power up your Mac or restart it, you should hear that familiar chime. If you'd like to turn it back off, you'll use the same command, but instead of percent 01 after the equals, you enter percent 01. And you're going to want to make sure and be careful that you get this command right. So I would again encourage you to check the show notes at maccast.com to get the exact command. But Apple Insider played around with this on a few models, and there was only, I think, one model they couldn't get it to work with. So it should work with most. Enjoy it while you got it, though, because like before, I have a feeling it's possible this might have been a mistake. Maybe Apple let it slip back in, and now that they know the cat is out of the bag, they could once again disable the secret command in a future Mac OS update. But we'll have to wait and see on that one. With that, though, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS. You can find more information and details on all of their software by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. You can leave a voicemail there. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And finally, if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or find me on Instagram at MacCast. That is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.